A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams, and we're here with a very special episode. We're very honoured to be able to present the audio for the 21st annual Tom Brock Lecture, which was held a couple of weeks ago. Andrew and myself attended and had an absolutely sensational night. I probably should disclose at this point that I've recently joined the Tom Brock Committee, which is a great honour for me because it's a cause that I believe in very strongly. And you've heard us talking about the Tom Brock Lecture over the last year. It really is one of the great rugby league nights, and I'm very happy to have the chance to take an active role in it going forward. As I said, we do have the audio of the event for you tonight. This comes courtesy of Crackernight Films, who filmed the event. The visual component of that will shortly appear on the Tom Brock website, so we'll give you an update when that's all sorted. So for tonight, you're going to hear Brayan Dabchek give a really fascinating talk on the history of the Rugby League Players Association. So this isn't a continuation of our Super League story, but there's a lot of parallels with what we've been talking about, including some direct references to Super League. But even so, as you see the formation of the Players Association and the evolution of industrial relations in rugby league over time, It's not hard to see how relevant it is to what we've been talking about with our Super League series. I was riveted by Brayan's talk, so I'm very excited to share it with you all. To set it up, though, I thought I might have a chat to a fellow Tom Brock committeeman, and that is a librarian at the State Library of New South Wales, Andy Carr, a good friend of mine who has been on the Tom Brock Committee for some time. And so I thought it was a good chance to bring him on to explain in a little more depth about who Tom Brock was and what this Tom Brock Lecture is all about. So I really appreciate Andy for coming on and going through it with us. We will have the continuation of the Super League saga returning next week. Apologies, we're a week late on this timeline. I was trying to have this lined up for last week and it didn't quite work out. So we'll be back with the Super League story next week. In the meantime, I really hope you enjoy my chat with Andy, and then we'll go straight to Brayan Dabchek and the Tom Brock Lecture. So I will speak to you next week. All right, well, I've subbed out one Andy for another. My usual co-host is in a deep depression recovering from the grand final. So in his place, I've got my friend, colleague, and now fellow Tom Brock Committee member, Andy Carr. How are you, Andy?
Hi, Mick. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm good. So, Andy, I wanted to get you on because we're about to play the audio of last week's... It was still last week, wasn't it?
Oh, the week before, by now, yeah.
The recent Tom Brock Lecture, anyway. So, I thought we've been plugging the event a lot on our show over the last year or so, but I really want to spread the word a bit more about Tom Brock and all the things that go into the Tom Brock Bequest Committee. So as someone who's been on the committee for a while, I thought I'd bring you on to just talk a bit about the committee and the aims of it.
Sure thing, Mick. Yeah, any odd excuse to talk about rugby league.
Yeah. And that's just, you know, an opening thing. That's my very favourite thing about the Tom Brock night. I had a wonderful night last week just talking footy with a variety of people, a very intelligent level of discourse.
That's right. It's always a great bunch of people who turn up to these things.
Yeah. So how long have you been going to them?
I went to the very first one, Mick, in 1999. Took my infant son along with me, and yeah, we went to the first one. And I've only ever missed one ever since then. I missed the very next one, which was the Ian Head's lecture.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I've been to them all.
And you've been on the committee all that time?
Well, not all that time. It probably goes back to the time when the Tom Brock Collection came to the State Library of New South Wales. I guess we should backtrack a bit and talk about why we have a Tom Brock Bequest Committee in the first place. So it's all about Tom Brock, Thomas George Brock, the historian. Tom was a Mad South supporter who spent most of his life just not only attending South's games, but just collecting and becoming the South Sydney historian. He was the first South Sydney were the first club to actually approach anybody to ask them to be their official historian. And in the Tom Brock collection, there's a lot of letters from people asking Tom to research ancestors who played for South Sydney. So people saying, you know, my granddad played for Souths in the 20s, and could I find out more about him? And so then Tom would do the work and get back to them. And in the course of doing that for about 10 years, he did assemble a lot of notes, as well as a lot of, you know, footy programs and footy cards and all sorts of things. So when Tom passed away, that was all passed on to the Australian Society for Sports History. And the society thought it would be good to start a group in Tom's name and to use the bequest. So Tom left a sum of money to the Australian Society for Sports History. And that money has now been used so that every year there's an annual Tom Brock lecture, there's a scholarship, and there's Tom's own collection.
Mm. I wanted to talk about the collection briefly.
Sure.
What, in your view, what are some of the highlights of that collection, in your opinion?
I guess the main thing is that he would collect and compile files on players and clubs. So a lot of it really is geared towards South Sydney. But he was a bit of a generalist as well, and he did collect a lot of earlier material from the birth of rugby league in Sydney onwards. You know, so there are a lot of early match programs and some pretty good sets of the rugby league news. Although if he couldn't get something, he would photocopy it. So there's a lot of copies of documents from other places. So I guess it really is the sum of its parts. I guess it's the most important thing, the fact that it's all in one place, and that, you know, people are able to come into the State Library and now look at all his collection in one go. It's all on the catalogue. A lot of his own handwritten material is part of the manuscripts collection, so it's kept in off-site storage. So we'll bring it in the next day. But it's really good to have it all in one place.
And those match programs, the rugby league news, it's really plugged quite a number of gaps in the State Library collection, hasn't it?
That's right, because the library only had a really sporadic collection of rugby league news. We had a lot of gaps, you know, for the 1950s and 60s. And I think at one stage we had like a 20-year gap. So having Tom's collection there has made a huge difference for us. And it's also meant that we have pretty much a copy of every issue, which we're able to then digitize and pop onto the Trove database. So now you can see the whole set of rugby league news, 1920 and 1973.
So anyone who has been going onto Trove and looking at those old rugby league news, you really have Tom Brock to thank that it's up there and available to view.
That's it. And it's really funny that some of them actually have Tom's writing all through them. Like he would take them to matches and he'd record the scrums and penalties.
Weather reports.
He'd tell you it was a fine sunny day or it was cloudy and foggy and all this. So it's really funny to see that. And you may not find that in the newspaper match reports of the games either.
Mm. Let's get onto the lecture, which, as we've discussed, is a great event. As someone who's been going to them since their birth, what are some of your favourite memories of the Tom Brock lectures?
I guess apart from the social element, which is a huge part of it, there have been some really interesting lectures. Probably for me, the highlight would be Roy Masters when he was talking about the great Fibros versus Silvertail wars of the 70s and 80s. And he was kind of debunking the myth a fair bit himself, and he was saying, well, you know, Manly weren't really Silvertails. I kind of made that up. And that class war, you know, aspect really got to the players and, you know, worked its magic for them. I really enjoyed Terry Williams's paper about all the lost clubs in rugby league, the clubs that have fallen by the wayside. Being a Balmain Tigers supporter, that's a subject quite close to my heart. And I guess since the Balmain merger, I've not really taken an active sort of role in following them. Like, I haven't followed the West Tigers. So at least being part of Tom Brock and going to the lectures keeps me involved, keeps me active and thinking about rugby league and rugby league history. I've still got the Newtown Jets to follow.
It seems a real theme among some attendees of Tom Brock. There seems to be a lot of old, you know, bitter Norths fans and Newtown fans and the rest of it.
That's right. A lot of us who have been hard done by over the years. But at least they've kept the interest in rugby league going, you know, which is awesome. And I guess we had a few years as well when there was no South Sydney in the NRL. So they were sort of hot times for the Brock in the early 2000s.
And as for the scholarship, what are the aims and what are you looking for?
So it's basically, I guess, a vehicle for people to promote rugby league history. Even not necessarily history, it could be anything current about rugby league as well, but it's just usually giving what's often a uni student the opportunity to do further work, you know, by helping to fund their research. So it's getting them involved in a topic they may not have thought of previously. Although a lot of them have come from rugby league backgrounds, they're rugby league fans or practitioners, and there's been some great work done on Pacific Islanders in rugby league, for example, and great work done by Kath Haynes on the women's games of rugby league in Sydney in the early 1920s. So it's brought a lot of great work out there over the last 20 years.
And just this is just my opinion, but just as the Tom Brock collection plugged a lot of holes, I think something like this really plugs a research hole that, you know, as someone who does rugby league research, I'm always looking for academic papers and that sort of thing, and there's just a real dearth.
There really hasn't been much lately, and I guess often it's the fact that these sports history journals are peer-reviewed and people don't feel that they can, you know, sort of go through with all that. And I guess that's why we haven't seen a lot in sporting traditions, like in the Australian Society for Sports History's journal. For the last sort of 5 years or so, there's been very little rugby league content. So this might be your big chance, Mick.
Don't give me more work to do, Andy, please. This is where I want to pivot to. Firstly, we're going to get to a very exciting announcement for Tom Brock in the next couple of months. But one of the things that Tom Brock did to commemorate the centenary of rugby league was to put out a bunch of papers about it. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So there was a one-day conference back in November of 2008, and it was a good time because it was when the Rugby League World Cup was on in Sydney, and it was when the Rugby League exhibition was on at the Powerhouse. So there was a lot going on to celebrate the 100 years. We even had a little display here at the library. So that was great. And we're sort of building on that. So that had a lot of papers on all sorts of aspects about rugby league in the country and rugby league during the war. And we're building on that now by having another one-day conference. So this one is happening as a celebration of 21 years of Tom Brock Bequest Committee. So that's going to be happening at Ryde Eastwood Leagues Club on the 11th of November.
Yeah, so 9 a.m. at Ryde Eastwood Leagues Club. We'll both be there. I'm really looking forward to this. There's a lot of good papers coming up. Are we in a position to disclose them yet, or is it?
I think it's all public now, Mick. So yeah. feel free to.
Well, how about you tell me a bit about what you're going to be talking about?
Yeah, I was going to save that for last, but that's all right. So what I'm doing? So I just mentioned Rugby League News, and I think that's an awesome source. Now for the Rugby League Historian, now that it's all completely available online. So I'll be basically looking at that as a source, how to get there online, doing a bit of background into the history of Rugby League News, why it was necessary in the first place, and looking at some of the intrigue over the years that you would find on the pages of Rugby League News. And, yeah, I guess kind of going up till 1973 when it became big league.
So it's going to be a bittersweet listening for me as someone who manually transcribed about 6 years worth of rugby league news from the 50s a couple of years before they were digitized.
So these modern researchers just don't know what they're missing, do they?
And apart from your talk, which is going to be great, there's current Tom Brock scholar Joe Gorman, who's going to be talking about the contents of his recently released book, Heartland. We've got the previous Tom Brock scholar, Spencer Casimir, discussing his work. He's concerned primarily with the Americanization of Australian sport.
That's right. He's really looking closely at rule changes over the years. Like one of his hobby horses is the move towards, from unlimited tackles to four tackles to six tackles, and looking at how much it borrowed from American football. We also have Kath Haynes, who was a former Tom Brock scholar, who's exploring further about the formation of the Women's Rugby League in the early 20s. And I think she brings up some angles she hadn't brought up previously, so that'll be really worthwhile.
And on top of that, a whole bunch more. We got about 12 speakers in total, don't we?
It's going to be a packed program, isn't it?
Yeah. So it promises to be a great day. As I said, I'll be there. Hope to see as many RLD listeners as possible. We'll be tweeting out the full program and how to RSVP on our social media. So that's the 11th of November at Ryde Eastwood Leagues Club.
And I look forward to seeing your tweets on the day, Mick.
Yes, we'll be all over that. So thanks for joining me, Andy. And for everyone else, we'll tune in to Bram Dabcek.
Thanks, mate.
Yep. All right. See you later.
I'm very happy to invite Bram to give his talk.
Thanks, Richard. I think I should sit down. There's only one way I can go, which is I'm quite embarrassed. Thank you very much. My voice is a bit croaky, so maybe I'm channeling Neville Rand. Well, there's Hazel, whoever. Anyway. I've got a cold at the moment. I just can't seem to shake it off, so please excuse my croaky voice. Now, I should explain, the Rugby League Players Association, their CEO, Ian Prendergast, who I've known for quite a period, I first met him when he was at the AFL Players Association. We were both on a player agent accreditation board. I think we first met in about 2010. Ian asked me to write a history of the Rugby League Players Association, and I did most of the research and writing in the latter part of last year. I hogged the photocopy machine for a whole month, managed not to break the photocopy machine, which I thought was my greatest achievement, and the RLPA will be producing their awards night on the 14th of October. They'll be releasing it then. It's about 30,000 words. I've written up a shorter version, which will appear in the Sporting Traditions. It's about 12,000 words. I'm not going to read it out because my eyesight's not that good. So I'm just going to talk to the paper and I'll try to take you quite quickly through 40 years of history. I'm biased because I find player associations fascinating. I think it's a very interesting history with twists and turns. Probably two general points that I'll make at the beginning is that what you might find at the end of the talk is you'll be surprised at how many player associations...
Carry on. Don't worry about me.
It's a microphone in my pocket. I'm not happy to see you.
Not what he said before.
That's one of my best jokes. My wife's here. I've been told not to tell jokes. So I quite enjoyed that, actually. sorry. I also laugh at my own jokes, so it's a good reason not to tell them. So what I was about to say, the first general point is that you might be surprised at the extent of player associations in the wonderful world of sport, not just here in Australia but across the globe. And for those of an industrial relations trade union bent, trade unions worldwide have gone like that. In player associations, they've gone like that. They've gone quite the opposite direction. It's one of the few examples, if you like, of positive player or worker activity, collective worker activity, where they actually do get results. The second thing is that what you'll find is that initially most of the players who were members of the Players Association were quite indifferent to its affairs, and it might be fair to say for the first 20 or even 30 years of its operation, the Rugby League Players Association wasn't very successful. It's really since about 2008, last decade or so, that they've had any really major success. And just to give you one dramatic example of that, part of the reason for that is it wasn't until 2008 that they actually had a home, a permanent home, where they managed to get the funds to open offices out at Olympic Park.
And in much the same way, none of us really grow up until we have a home of our own. I think that's also true of the Rugby League Players Association. And to my mind, probably the most important event in the history of the Rugby League Players Association, certainly in the recent history, it triggers a whole series of events, and I'll come to this, is the Melbourne Storm salary cap scandal of 2010. Because what that episode did is it galvanised the playing group, and the players became more involved in the affairs of the Players Association to the extent that the existing leadership got rolled or was forced out effectively because the players were unhappy with the way in which it was operating, which is a bit of a shock to the leadership because they always try to get the players involved. So a key event is the Melbourne Storm salary cap. And in some ways, David Gallop is a very important person in galvanising the Players Association. He also had a similar effect with the female soccer players, because the way he treated them, that forced them to actually do something about it and get their act together. So the last decade has been one of achievement. Now, having said that, there's also been a series of fights and struggles between leadership groups, between players and leaders. And when I was thinking about this, I thought, how should I view this? Should there be fights? There shouldn't be fights, whatever. What was the position of the various protagonists? And whilst the protagonists, fought with each other quite hard and they weren't ruthless, and they said nasty things about each other. I mean, rugby league players seem to swear a little bit, unlike the rest of us. But it was never about ideology. The disputes are about how can we get better? How can the Players Association get better? And it's through that process that the Players Association did become effective, because through the struggle, trying to work, the argument was, what can we do to get better? Should we fight for more? Should we reach an agreement here? And so on. And through this process, they actually learned how to become an effective organisation. But it's only really in the last 25% of its life, the last 10 years, that has been it's been effective. So that's way of an introduction. Now, Arthur Beetson, legendary player Arthur Beetson, he called a meeting that formed the Players Association April of 1979. We're not exactly sure what day in April, and we're pretty sure it happened at the Balmain Rugby Leagues Club. Now, Arthur was of the view, or Big Artie was of the view, the players weren't well treated. He played with Balmain from 66 to 1970, and in that period he says he might have earned $10,000. Which works out at about $40 a week, which is pretty much similar to what the minimum basic wage was in that era. He was a star player. He also played for the Kangaroos 3 years. So he was one of the leading players on basically very low levels of income. And players of that era only got paid at the end of the season, so they had to have other jobs to live. Otherwise, they couldn't survive. He was one of the few players who supported Dennis Tutty in his campaign against the old transfer system. There were three players from Balmain that supported Dennis Tutty. Tutty fought that case on the wages of an unskilled labourer. To the extent that he had help, the lawyers went slow with the demand for payments and just hoped they'd win the case and then get compensated that way. So Dennis Tutty is seen as a legend in amongst the playing group. Who took on the transfer system and won, only received support from three players. There was no players' association to help him. Now, in 1991, I remember listening to 2BL and Arthur Beetson said the reason why he formed the players' association is he felt the players needed to have their voice heard. It was very basic. Now, once he formed the players' association, basically Arthur stood back. Now, If you go back, I can find an example of players in 52, the Kangaroos 52-53, thought about forming a players' association, but in the 70s there's a degree of agitation, different players at different times saying we need a players' association. Arthur held that first meeting. Now, OK, it's a great idea to form a players' association. How are we going to make it work? Who's going to do it? And basically what happened is that none of them had an idea how to do it, even though they might have, a lot of them had working class roots or trade union connections and so on, but they, as players, didn't know how to do it. And there's a little bit of pass the parcel, who's going to do what. So the first year, basically nothing much happens. And Martin Gallagher, former South player, he goes to Jack Gibson, former East player. I'm pretty sure they used to bash each other up in the 50s. You all know who Jack Gibson is. And he says to Jack, look, nothing's going on here. You've got to sort us out. Jack didn't want to do it. He changed his mind. He came on board. He was able to organise things. His lawyer sort of worked out how to do things. Jack put in $1,000 of his own money to sort of sort things out. Now, the thing is that the early leaders were all, well, to the extent they were part-time. They didn't actually have any full-time officials they didn't really have any full-time officials until the 2000s, end of the 90s, the 2000s. Now, the two major figures Jack were John Adam and Kevin Ryan. They were both lawyers, but they did their leadership works on top of being full-time lawyers. One was a barrister, one was a solicitor. So most of the people who were involved in the leadership did it on a part-time basis. They had full-time jobs. And they were professionals, and professional jobs can be quite demanding, and then they do things at night or on the weekend and so on. So the first period, the Players Association basically was going nowhere. Now, in the 80s, the Rugby League wanted to reintroduce the transfer system. And as a result of this, they needed to get the players on side so it wouldn't be challenged in the courts, because if you get the players to agree to a transfer system. So the leadership agreed to it. And then they got recognition about 82, 83. So what you have in the 80s is you've got a group of part-time leaders looking after, being recognised by the Rugby League. They're doing things on a part-time basis. So as you can imagine, you tend to be mainly reactive. Do things part-time, it's casual, and so on. So it's not as if you actually got any plans or strategies to improve things. So their major role was to attend to grievances of players. You know, they weren't paid their contracts, or they got injured, didn't get their medical bills paid. Clubs found ways to take money off them, fine them for this, that, and the other, turning up late for training, and you know, usual sort of stuff as clubs try. Because the clubs will pay the players at the end of the season, so then you've got to siphon out the money. So if you could fine them for all these sort of things, you have to pay out as much, so you're financially better off. Now, the funniest thing I've ever found in terms of my research in sports is this following grievance. A player went to the Players Association. He'd run out of his contract with his club in France because the club had decided to reduce his payments. And the reason why the club had reduced his payments is because the manager of the club took a dislike to the player's wife because she wouldn't go shopping or go for a walk on the park on Wednesday afternoons so he could entertain his lady friends at their flat because, as he said, going to hotels was just too expensive. So that's the funniest grievance I've come across in my... And I've been looking at this for 40 or 50 years. So I thought I should tell you that actually happened. OK, so what happens is you've got a part-time leadership and it's reactive to events. Now, what happened in the late 80s, the Rugby League wanted to introduce the draft. Now, I assume you don't know what the draft is. So it's what's called the internal draft. Rather than players moving to a club of their choice at the end of their contracts, if clubs want them, all players who fell out of contract with their clubs would be placed into a national pool. The players couldn't bargain with who they were employed by. Clubs could choose them, with the bottom club having first choice, second bottom club having second choice, etc., etc., up to the premiers, and you repeat the process a number of times. Now, the problem with this for the playing group was that most of the players, they only paid at the end of the year. They lived in the same area where the clubs they played with. Their wife had employment in the same area. The kids went to schools in the same area. So the thought of having to transfer to different parts of Sydney or Newcastle or Canberra or wherever was anathema to them because it would muck up their domestic arrangements. So when the Rugby League announced it, John Adam, the lawyer, said, well, OK, well, let's just wait and see what they're going to do. And then Kevin Ryan, a group of players and coaches went to Kevin Ryan. Kevin Ryan said, well, this sounds to me like an unreasonable restraint of trade. Basically, stuff them. And if they want to introduce it, well, I'll take them to the courts, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this led to the first big fight within the Players Association group. And to cut a long story short, John Adam got sidelined. There were some monster meetings, Coogee, 300 players, coaches and so on. You look at the minutes of the time, it's full of, you know, nasty accusations. You're in bed with the rugby league. You know, you've got no guts. You've got, or contrary-wise, you've got no idea what you're doing. Let's wait for them. Anyway, so the rugby league introduced the draft. I was a so-called expert witness. Despite my evidence, we won the case. The judge didn't like me at first instance. At least the went to appeal, and the not that I got mentioned in the appeal case. Anyway, there's a very strong statement from the judges about the draft as unreasonable restraint of trade was compared to serfdom. So this is a major, it's a major case, not just for rugby league players, but for players as a whole, about the human rights, employment rights of players. So Kevin won that. He also negotiated the first collective bargaining agreement in the history of Australian sport, with a minimum wage of $20,000 for the top players, minimum wage of $8,000 for the second string. That's going down to the second team players. And that AFL negotiated agreements just slightly after, and its minimum wage for all the players was $7,500. So Kevin Ryan won the draft case, had the first collective bargaining agreement in the history of Australian sport. He's a should be seen as a major figure in the history, not just rugby league, but the history of Australian sport. And we all know that Kevin is a character, or he's a fascinating, larger-than-life figure. Well, these are some of his major achievements that should be recognised. Now, in the early 90s, Kevin seems to have wanted to disentangle from the Players Association, and he sought a merger with the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance. So for those of us who remember the 90s, in terms of the trade union world, we're engulfed by the need for union amalgamation, one of Bill Keldy's ideas, completely stuffed up the trade union movement. You know, when the new right were trying to take unions on, the last thing you want to do is rearrange the deck chairs, rather than you just got to forget about all that stuff. You just got to, you know, react to what's going on around you rather than try to rearrange yourself. Now, I've spoken to people from the Media Entertainment Arts Alliance. They agree that the merger was well, it was a disaster, to be honest. Peter Moscat, a former East player, he was working for the Media Alliance, and virtually immediately after that, the merger was agreed, Moscat and Ryan were at each other's throats, arguing about, you know, who's selling out, blah, 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 usual sort of stuff of, you know, inter-union conflict, denouncing each other. So what happens is, in this environment where you've got this two rival organisations claiming for the players sort of lost interest in the Players Association. So if you like, the players, they fell between the two stools. But in a sense, this may, looking back on it, I don't think it really mattered that much, because there was something worse that was about to hit the Players Association, or the idea of a Players Association, and that was Super League. So I think we all remember Super League. And basically what happened is you get the News Limited competing with, as it was then, the Australian Rugby League for teams, players, coaches, referees, the whole, you know, game, grounds, the whole the whole box and dice. And what you find is the player salaries go through the roof. So the Johns brothers, for example, were on about $20,000 and $40,000 each. The younger was on the lower figure. Lower Johns was on the lower figure. Once News Limited, you know, the Super League war came, they were being offered sort of a signing on fee of $200,000 to $250,000, and then annual salaries of $300,000 for about 4 or 5 years. So you get guys on both sides being offered enormous amounts of money. And so with all this money on offer, players thought, well, what's the need for a players' association? So the contracts, in some of the contracts, they for the stars, range from 3 to 7 years. Andrew Eddinghausen, for example, was on a 7-year contract. Very big money. We're talking, in some cases, $500,000-$600,000 a year. And this is 20-odd years ago. So players thought, well, who needs a players' association? And, of course, one of the problems with this is that it led to the rise of the player agent, because player agents take 6% of the salaries. And they usually take 20% of monies that they get for endorsements and all that sort of stuff. So it created a new force. So what happens is, for all intents and purposes, the Players Association's dead in the latter half of the 90s, and I could find very few records and so on of that era. Now, what happens is the Kangaroos come back from England at the end of 2000, and all the big contracts are coming to an end.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, they're about to expire. And as you know, Super League was, well, the Super League war was a disaster for both sides. It said that News Limited dropped over $500 million on the Super League war. And then the two merged, and we have the formation of the National Rugby League in 1997. So it was at 1998. And then the big contracts dry up, and the Kangaroos come back, and they sort of work out, oh, hang on, things are going to get a bit dicey now with News Limited really running the show. I think you all know there was a joint partnership point up, 3 from ARL and 3 from News Limited, and they spend the next... 10, 15 years just hating each other, both sides. Rugby League was incapable of any innovation. David Gallup, if you asked him about, well, what ideas have you got for the future? That's not something that we do. So it became like a lot of sports are really badly administered. I mean, they're unbelievably administered. And what happened with the TV deals? Do I need to tell you what happened with the TV deals? I think you know what happened with the TV deals. So you've got News Limited negotiating with itself about the TV rights. If you compare the TV deals that Rugby League got in that era with the TV deals that the AFL got, there's a very big difference, and you can sort of work out, if you wanted, you could sort of work out how much each player lost each year as a result of the TV deals if you just... What's it? Benchmark. That's the management term if you benchmark it against the AFL experience. Anyway, so the players come back, the Kangaroos come back, and they go to Tony Butterfield, who's a retired Newcastle player, and they say, Tony, well, we think we need a players' association, and we want you to lead it. And he says, OK, I'll do it. Now, Tony's based in Newcastle, and all the action's here in Sydney, so he's driving backwards and forwards from Newcastle. He's basically got no income, so he's got to persuade the players to provide him with income, and so on. And so he spent the next 4 or 5 years, amongst other things, trying to extract income from the playing group or get them to go to functions like a golf day or this, that or the other where they could extract some sort of money to run the organisation. So he spent most of his time chasing players for money. The agents are trying to get the players not to worry about the Players Association, et cetera, et cetera. And he's finding it very difficult to negotiate with the Rugby League. The National Rugby League with David Gallup. And the other part of the story is Gallup and Butterfield really didn't like each other. And I think the major problem is that it's Tony Butterfield was the problem, because Tony's not the sort of guy who likes hearing bullshit. Okay, he's not the guy to be seduced by a manager, someone who tells you, yeah, I really like you, but I can't give you anything. He doesn't accept that. He's a front row forward, and he just wants to barge forward. And I call the section where I look at Tony Butterfield, I said, Tony Butterfield, the bull at the gate. And that was his sort of attitude. And Gallup knew there was nothing he could do to seduce, if I can use that word, to get Butterfield to calm down. And so he kept on going at him. So Tony spent a lot of time and effort trying to negotiate with the rugby league to no avail. And so what he did is he got in touch with people from the unions New South Wales, or was that, that's what it's called now. It used to be called the New South Wales Labor Council, Australian Council of Trade Unions and so on. And he met a guy called Tony Slevin, a lawyer who worked for the CFMEU. It's now the CFEMEU. And Tony interviewed Tony Slevin. And Tony's advice to him was, well, if you want to get something, what you've got to do is get registered under the the Federal Industrial Relations legislation. And if they don't want to play ball, you take him to the commission and you bang him around the head with the... Now, for those of us who know these things, the commission's powers were being diminished in that period. But anyway, so this is the advice, and the advice essentially worked. And the other part of the story is that, you know, they were finding it very difficult to get the, you know, NRL to come to the party. And so they wanted to do something to sort of put pressure on, but they didn't want to upset the spectators, the fans of rugby league. So they decided they'd ban the Daily M's in 2003, and Craig Gower was odds on to win it. And once Gallup heard that they were going to do this, he said to Tony, can you just hang on, don't make an announcement. And then he went and made an announcement and cancelled the Daily M's. But what this did is that it demonstrated to Gallup that he'd lost the stars, and eventually it forced an agreement. And the agreement was the sorts of money. There's a salary cap of about, depending on, it's all these little bits and pieces, so it's about $3 to $3.5 million per club. It's a very comprehensive type of agreement with leave, entitlements, a medical, a whole range of issues that you'd find in a normal collective bargaining agreement. So it's the foundation of the subsequent collective bargaining agreements. And so they negotiated an agreement. So it's important. And basically, what I think you can say is that it's just Tony Butterfield's unrelenting determination that got it across the deal. He just was not going to back off. Now, Tony was based in Newcastle, and so he was a bit exhausted by the end of this process after he got the deal, and he decided he wanted to sort of back off, do stuff in Newcastle, and then one of his problems was to find someone to replace him. And so he found Matt Rodwell. They played together. Matt Rodwell played at a number of clubs. He'd retired a few years earlier. Matt was looking for a chance to go into sports administration. So he took up the mantle about 2005. And Matt... They still don't have an office at this stage. They don't have a... So Tony was doing it. His office was his car or a spare room in his home in Newcastle. That was his office. So Matt, he operated out of a small room at the back of a shop in Gosford. So the room was probably about as big as this stage. And he asked a guy called Jamie Barrington, who's the CFO of the Dragons at the moment. He's an accountant. Asked him to be his CFO. So what we find is that the first full-time official is Tony Butterfield, and 2005 they've got two full-time officials, which is Matt Rodwell and Jamie Barrington, and they're operating out of his office in Gosford. Now, Matt Rodwell's a different type of person to Tony Butterfield, sorry, to Tony Butterfield, who's a much more gentle. Now he's under no illusions. He told me it took him about 12 or 18 months to actually develop a sort of a convivial relationship with the rugby league. He was also under instructions from his board to develop a more cooperative relationship rather than a confrontational one with the rugby league. But one of his great problems was he didn't have enough, they didn't have funding to look after himself. And so what he wanted was he wanted the rugby league to provide the Players Association with funding. Now, the way in which most of the sports operate, just not in Australia but across the globe, is that the leagues provide funds to the Players Association. And the way it works is, it's generally seen as this, the players shall receive a share of revenue, and part of the revenue that goes to players will be directed to the Players Association to fund its activities to look after the players. So in a sense, the players' salary sacrifice to give funds to the Players Association. Now, most of the sports in Australia had these arrangements, but not rugby league. So Matt Robwell wanted was he wanted each of the clubs of their salary cap of about $3.5 million. He wanted 20,000 of that for each club to go to the Players Association, which would give them from the clubs an income of 320,000 plus about other income that they raise from membership and functions and so on, maybe another 100,000, so they'd have an income of 420,000. So this is 2000. Now this actually happened in 2007. So 2006, their income was God knows what it really was, but in 2007, their income goes to about 420,000. So they get 20,000 from each club. Now, the rugby league said, well, if you want that, we don't want you to be registered with the commission. Now, Rodwell and Barrington didn't rate being registered very highly. They didn't see that as something important. So, in a sense, what Butterfield achieved for them, he gave them something they could trade. And the rugby league agreed to that. Now, but then this led to another big fight, because Tony Butterfield was horrified at what they were doing. He said, well, if you can't go to the commission, they'll screw you. There's no guarantee that they'll actually give you the revenue. You can't trust the buggers. And Rodwell wanted a 4-year deal, and Butterfield said you should only have a 2-year deal. So there's another fight. There's some extraordinary exchanges in the correspondence. And what happened was, Rodwell and Barrington said if they didn't get that deal, if they didn't get secure funding, then they would have walked away. And I guess if that had have happened, I think the Players Association would have folded, because no one else really wanted to do it. So Butterfield got yelled down and he had to back off, which is quite sad, because he achieved a remarkable amount for the Players Association. So he got sidelined. Now, what's important about that is that whether Tony was right or not, what Rodwell did is secured the financial base of the Players Association. They had regular income for the first time. So this formed in 79, 2007, 28 years later, they actually get regular funding. Now, in terms of an organisation, if you haven't got funds, you can't do anything. You're really constrained. And then as a result of that funding, they then had their permanent offices. They got a permit office at Olympic Park. So they actually had a home. So it took them 28, 29 years to actually establish themselves. Okay, so then what happens is Matt Rodwell then gets an offer to go into the commercial world, which he does. He's basically worker compensation. He works in that area in town with... Jamie Barrington got an offer, later on. So the Players Association then needed a new leader and they advertised, and the person they chose, a guy called David Garnsey.
Now, what's important to note about David Garnsey is he's the first non-rugby league person, non-rugby league player to be a leader. He's a lawyer. He's a sports nut. And the reason why they chose him, he'd written a number of articles around the Super League war, where he looked at all the various sorts of cases, and he was looking for a chance to... Excuse me, I'll just have a quick drink. And I can even bend down that far. Remarkable. If I can give you some advice, don't get old. But it's better than the alternative. OK, you haven't heard that before either. OK, so they chose David Garnsey. He's a lawyer. He worked for one of the better firms in town. He's looking for a change. Now, when you're a lawyer who works for the better firms in town, you have a lot of support. You know, there's all these people running around doing things for you. Now, when he got to the Rugby League Players Association, he discovered he didn't have that sort of support. So he appointed a guy called Ben Barber as his financial guy. So they had two officials. So until 2013, the Rugby League Players Association had two full-time officials from basically Matt Rodwell. You know, from 2005 to 2013, they went from none to one to two full-time officials. They've now got 11 full-time officials. The Rugby League's got 470 full-time staff. As of late last year, maybe it's gone up or down since then. OK, so they've expanded. David Garnsey starts, and then we have the Melbourne Storm salary cap issue, which I think you all know about, which I don't need to go through. Now, the most important thing to note about that is that whilst the club and all that club was fined, the major decision for us is that they decided to take the premierships off the players. Now, the players were prepared to wear everything except that. And you know why players would want to have their premierships maintained, because that's what their whole being's about. And the players were upset about that. Now, Garnsey attended a meeting in Melbourne after this, and it's not exactly clear what happened at the meeting. I've heard different reports which all seem to head in the same direction, but what it amounts to is that... Now, remember, the Players Association had two staff, hardly any money. And things are becoming more complicated, and they're based here, and Melbourne Storm is in Melbourne. Storm players wanted the Players Association to fight it, and he said no. Didn't say it like that, but that's... And so the players thought that they'd been abandoned by the Players Association. Now, what's important about this is that you've got Cameron Smith. You've got the Stars. I mean, the Stars of the Melbourne Storm are the sort of the backbone of the Queensland State of Origin team. In turn, they're the backbone of the Kangaroos. So as a result of this, the Players Association, or David Garnsey, they're the same thing, are on the nose with the Stars. And this is the crucial turning point. So what happens is the Stars are upset. So Cameron Smith, all the leading sort of players, particularly the Queensland players, start to complain about what's going on. Cameron Smith sort of hints, well, there might be a strike in the future. And they complain about State of Origin. You know, the amount of money we're paid chicken feed, half of it's kept for when we retire. That was introduced to stop Stars jumping to rugby union or going elsewhere. You know, Lottie Decury, et cetera, those types of players who jumped. So they say, well, you know, the State of Origin money's pathetic. Half of it disappears. Once we pay for, say, getting our family to attend and you take the tax out, we're getting paid peanuts. Then you want us to pay 2 days later for a club game, so we're going to get burned out. This is, you know, pathetic. And so the players start to agitate. So the players get upset. And they're basically, it's the players
the star players agitating and they start talking to each other. And there's different groups. It's not as if there's one group. There's some players say, well, OK, what we should do is get active, get in the Players' Association. Others sort of say a certain word. I can't say the Players' Association. OK, so there's... But what's happening is they're talking about the Players' Association and they're saying we should get things... We should sort of get active with it. Well, some saying with it, or we should bypass it and so on. Now, what happens is that 2011 and 12, the salary cap under Matt Rodwell goes up to about $4 million to $4.2 million, depending on what year. So it's gone from about $3 million to $4.2 million. And under Matt Rodwell, the percentage, it's about a 20 to 22% share of revenue. Okay, that's use that as a benchmark, give you an idea of what share of revenue players are getting. That's all up. All other bits and pieces and so on is included. So the players sort of get agitated and they actually have meetings with Gallup and so on. And then Gallup sort of assured, so he basically deals with the players. He negotiates with the players and he's prepared to actually give players more increase, not the salary cap, but a marquee player allowance, a veterans allowance, a car allowance and all this sort of stuff. So they're prepared to provide extra money for this. Basically, it'll go to the stars to keep them happy. And then Gallup goes to the clubs. The clubs agree to this, then it goes to the Players' Association and basically gives them a fait accompli. So even though it goes up, it's really induced by the players rather than the Players' Association as such. So it's sort of they're separate. So anyway, the next collective bargaining agreement coming up to be negotiated. Now what I've done is I've just ignored all the complications on the rugby league side with the News Limited disappearing, when will the TV negotiations occur, how will they structure? And if you want to read about what happened with the on the rugby league side, you should read David Trotton's The Commission We Had to Have, which was published after I did my work, and which I've read, which is an excellent account. I wish I had had it. I could have used his nasty quotes against the rugby league establishment. I was a bit too wary of doing it in case I'd get... thump with... Yeah, they've got a lot of money and I haven't, so you tend to be a little bit wary. So I had to sort of tone myself down a little bit on that score. But David Trotton's book gives an excellent account of what happened there. Now, David Garnsey, he was one of two staff and he had to negotiate a new collective bargaining agreement. And basically he didn't think he could do it himself. And he employed two consultants. One of them is Brendan Schwab. I don't know if you've heard of Brendan Schwab. Very active in the soccer area, not just in Australia and overseas, also overseas. He also formed an organisation called the Australian Athletes Alliance. So all the players' associations, I think all the player associations in Australia belong to this alliance. It's a peak player association body. And Brendan was also appointed head of the World Players Association, which is based in Neon, Switzerland. He was appointed there in 2015. Amongst player association people, probably amongst sports administrators, he's regarded as a genius. He's one of the smartest guys I've ever met. The second person David asked to help was, you're looking at him. Now, I always thought with David and Brendan, they're both workhorses, I always felt that I was lazy compared to them. I just worked there. They worked themselves into the grave, literally. Not literally, but they just worked so hard, and I just was amazed at how hard they worked. Now, one of the problems David had, and this should be put on the record, and I only found about this subsequently, he didn't actually have the money to pay us. Well, the Players Association didn't have the money to pay us. And he actually paid us and other expenses out of his own pocket, which he recouped. Oh, I've got to hurry up. I'll just speed through it. But it's the most interesting part, so I'll keep going. And they don't look bored, actually. Not even Pam, which is remarkable. Anyway, so, well, she does now. I'm in trouble. I might have to stay with you. So David put up money to pay, which he recouped after the event. And it should be, I think, acknowledged what he did. Now, to cut a long story, well, one of the problems was also that David didn't have the support of the playing group, which is a problem. Now, I didn't know about this at the time. I only know about it subsequently when I did the research. And I remember at one stage, and I wish Clint Newton was here because Clint's really important to what happened. Clint was, I think you all know who Clint is. Clint had just come back from overseas. He was playing with Penrith. He got in touch with David and said he wanted to become involved in the negotiations, which was a bit, you know. So there was a meeting, and Clint came on board. Now, what happened was that Clint had a spy there. Some players were involved. The player concerns Anthony Quinn. And he was telling Clint what was going on. And he's saying to Clint, well, I don't think the negotiations are going very well. So Clint got in touch, and he met Brendan and David. And he said he wanted to come on board. And so he did. And he worked out that if things were going to improve, had to get the star players on side. And so he worked on the star players, the Cameron Smiths, Jonathan Thurstons, those types of guys. He worked on them through player connections, and he also got the coaches involved. He got the coaches to put pressure on those guys. And his basic line was, look, it looks like we can probably get a decent deal because we worked out a strategy. We were after a 25% share of revenue. Remember, 20 to 22, wanted substantially increased stuff. So we want to go 25%. And Clint worked out or was told that, you know, we had a good approach, just we didn't have the backing of the players. And so Clint talked. He said to them, look, guys, I don't care what you think about in the past. This is our chance. Either we go with it or we don't. We can achieve something. So he got the stars to attend a particular meeting, about nine stars to attend. I won't read out their names. And once those guys turned up, it just changed the dynamics of the whole negotiations. I remember going home one night and Pam said to me, how did the negotiations go today? And I sort of basically, you know, put my head on my hand, started to cry and said, I can't see any end to it. They won't take us seriously. And within the next 6 days, we had the contours of the subsequent agreement that we reached. Now, the agreement is quite comprehensive. I just want to highlight a few key points. We increased the salary cap into the sort of $6 to $7 million a club. Payments for the Players Association was about $1.5 million, gone from $320,000 to about $1.5 million. It's a fivefold increase. We increased the salary. The minimum salary was to $75,000. We had the highest minimum salary in Australian sport. We achieved contract security, so if players got injured, their contracts would be paid out. As a whole, we increased put money into a retirement fund for players. It increased from about $3,000 to about $9,000 to $10,000 over the life of the agreement. So I'm biased and I've got a conflict of interest, but it was a much better agreement. We went from a 20 to 22% share to a 25% share. Now, despite this, David was still on the nose with the player group. And so events happened in 2015 and then David decided he had enough and he walked away from the Players Association. He just realised he lacked the confidence of the playing group. So Clint, who was playing, living in Newcastle, he took over the affairs of the Players Association in 2015 for a very brief period, and he encouraged a guy called Ian Prendergast, who was with the AFL Players Association through connections with the Australian Athletes Alliance, and asked him to become the new CEO of the Players Association. And Ian agreed to that. So he rebuilt the Players Association from basically 2015-2016. So when we negotiated the 13-17 agreement, there were two staff By the time David left, there were seven staff. So they'd gone from two to seven, enlarged, they refurbished Olympic Park. And then when Ian took over, and note that Ian's not a rugby league player, he's a former AFL player. He worked with the AFL Players Association for about 6 or 7 years. He'd helped organise one of the sort of the major collective bargaining deals involving the playing group. About 800 players attended a player meeting either personally or via, you know, Skype and the way video conferencing. He'd organised that. He'd been to America, met the Major League Baseball Players Association, and they said, well, what's the key to being a successful players association? And they said, well, there's three things: organise, organise, organise. So Ian brought those here. He also employed a guy called Tim Light. He'd been with the New Zealand Cricketers Association and the Netball Association, also been with the Australian Cricketers Association, and he'd been part of the negotiations that led up to the cricket dispute. So he had a very good idea of what's going on. I also employed a guy called Adrian Turner, who'd worked with the Rugby Union Players Association. Now, all three of those guys are lawyers, have legal backgrounds. They employed other people, like good friend Brock there. So then it went to 10 staff, 11 staff. So what I guess the key thing about Ian is he professionalised the Players Association. You've got, instead of people who are, oh, I'm a player, I want to do the right thing, you've got people with experience. And then when it came to the negotiations of the most recent collective bargaining agreement, well, it's pretty, I mean, Ian will tell you it wasn't easy, but what he did was he got the players behind them in the negotiations, you know, when things got a little bit dicey with the with Todd Greenwood and Weeks and so on. They'd get the player groups, players involved. Then they negotiated their most recent collective bargaining agreement, and this increased the player share of revenue to 29.5%. And we're now talking about salary caps in the range of $9 to $10 million, depending on how you define them, plus there's these whole host of other benefits. So if you go back to, say, Matt Rodwell, where the player share was 20 to 22%, it's now 29.5%. And to the extent there's extra revenues over the predictions, then they'll get a share of that, and so on. Now, if I can finish, when the Players Association formed, Russell Pilley issued one of the earliest documents that I have, a one-pager to prospective members, and he said he was going to hold a meeting at the Crest Hotel in King's Cross. He said, "The objects of the association are far-reaching and will maximise the interests of all players in this profession." And Big Artie said the reason why he wanted a players' association was because he wanted players to have a say in the decision-making process. Both of these men were on the money. So ends the first 40 years of the history of the Rugby League Players Association. Thank you very much.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.